Radio City. John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you on PopDose.com, having a good time and bringing you our take on some of the things going on in the world of pop culture this week. And Rob Ross, how's everything in your world?
So far, so good, John. I can't complain, thank God. So all is well right now.
Very good. Well, we've got a bunch to go over this time around, and we're going to start with one that is going to, again, turn our normal way of doing things on its head, because how can you not start with one of the sad goodbyes and fond farewells that we had this week? Because there were a couple of note, but I think they were all outshined by the fact that we lost a guy who is a comedy legend. And I want to get your take on Don Rickles and his work and his career first, and then we'll talk a little bit more about it. But it was, you know, again, it's hard to call it a shock when somebody's into his 80s. And yet, when the comedy world loses somebody, the like of which we really didn't have any other ones, there was no other Don Rickles, you know, that's where it really starts to come clear that this is going to take a toll.
Well, you know something, Hockey Puck. It's like this. Don Rickles was one in a million.
Yep.
Anyone who even remotely tried to approximate what he did never reached the apex in which he did it. Mm-hmm. First of all, Rickles never really used obscenity, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, his shtick and his act and his insult comedy, quote unquote, was always clean.
Right.
It didn't need to be censored. It was just the delivery and the skewering of the words and the tone and the tempo in which he went and did it. Case in point, you can go back and watch any clip on YouTube of his best moments when he was on Johnny Carson's show, whether it was sparring back and forth with Johnny, with Frank Sinatra, at a Dean Martin celebrity roast. Rickles was a master of the timing and the drop-dead, poker-faced insult.
Yep.
He was a master of deadpan.
Right. And those things that he did on Carson, a lot of times he would take shots at the other guests before they even came out because he knew who was coming out after him. And the quickness and the ability to riff at a second's notice, that was what I thought was his real brilliance, is that he was never at a loss for words.
No, but he did it in such a... everybody was in on the joke.
Yep.
To begin with.
Right.
Because if you ever listened to one of his full bits, whether it was one of his TV appearances, or if you got to see him like I very fortunately did get to do...
Good for you.
In 2008, I believe it was, I got to see him at Town Hall. He always ended it with a knowing embrace for the entire audience.
Yes.
You know, you're in on the joke. You have to be. If you're actually insulted by Don Rickles, you're a moron. Because factually speaking, there isn't a writer or journalist I can think of that didn't basically ask him, please insult me.
Yeah.
Rickles was just somebody who knew how to do it and did it with that lightning, as you said, with that lightning quickness and with that kind of like, I don't want to say breaking the fourth wall, but it was almost like he turned to the audience and wink and then let you have it.
Mm-hmm.
You were in on the joke. And he was just a genuinely funny guy. And also, I don't think I've ever heard a bad word spoken about the man.
No.
He was that loved.
Yeah, and he was... The reason why I wanted you to start this off is because there are people... And to me, Don Rickles is one of them. I mean, everybody has their own tastes, and it's certainly not an insult to him or to his career. It speaks for itself. The work speaks for itself. But what I'll tell you is that he was never really my thing. You know, it was a matter of just personal taste. It was like, I get it, and I know what he was trying to do. But the thing is, there are people like that, that even if it's not something that you naturally gravitate toward, you can appreciate the talent that it takes to do it. And that's where I am with Don Rickles, because I never denied that the guy was brilliant at what he did. So in that, I think that the true brilliance shone through, and this is why he was always there on those celebrity roasts, like you were alluding to. Not only was everybody in on the joke, he took shots, scattershot. There was nobody that was safe from the acerbic part of his humor, but you never felt like Don Rickles was doing it to be mean. It was insult comic, yes, but those insults were never meant to demean you or to make you feel bad on your way out the door.
Correct. I think the only time that, if you want to call it uncomfortable, if you will, was he was doing the celebrity roast for Jerry Lewis, and he took shots at Milton Berle. And Milton Berle didn't have a very good sense of humor, okay. ironically enough. So he seemed a little crotchety, and I think I'm putting it very diplomatically there. But the thing is that, you know, Rickles did it with that, like I said, with that wink and the nod to everybody, so everyone was in on the joke, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Right.
You know, and that's why he was able to do it with such fluidity. I mean, you would watch him off the cuff. I remember seeing it seemed like an improvised clip to a degree. Regis Philbin was opening up for Rickles. I don't know, it was maybe in the 80s or something. And it was videotaped by Regis Philbin knocking on his door and then Rickles just unloading on him, machine gunning him. Mm-hmm. And there was no way Philbin could control himself. He was just in hysterics. He was trying desperately to be stoic and you know, interview him and talk to him in the proper way with the microphone. And Rickles just was giving it to him like there was no tomorrow.
Yeah.
And you couldn't help but lose it. You know, and then you'd go back and watch something like CPO Sharky, which I actually watched when it was on the air. And it was a great sitcom, but Rickles gave it that little extra bit of vitriol that made it spicier and funny. And let's face it, you had to love that show because they had the Dickies on.
Yeah, exactly.
So and I don't want to go off on a tangent, but I mean, that was kind of ballsy. So
yeah, and he had one of the great angry faces. I mean, during the run of that show, when he was really laying into somebody, and I mean, putting on the angry routine, the way that his eyes would bulge out and you could see the corded muscles in his neck, it was great.
He had that look of the angry military guy, you know?
But, yeah.
I used to just, there are so many wonderful things to say about him. So, look, he's gone, and we were very lucky we had him for 90 years. So, yeah, of course it's a loss. Is it a shock? No, but it's still a loss.
Yep.
And I'm very glad that I did get to see him. I knew we had to go see him as he was getting older, just to have that one experience. He may not have been at his absolute best, but he sure as hell gave it all. Very good, you know, very good performance, because he was on for a long while.
Right, right. And you know, the one thing that I think has been the conversation, just to look at the cultural response to all of this, is that he couldn't. If he started his career today, it wouldn't work because everybody is such a candy ass today. I mean, there's nobody who understands how not to take themselves too seriously. And, oh, you can't say something like that. And it's true. I mean, if you attempted to do that kind of humor, even if you were being, again, measured about it and fair about it and taking shots at everybody, all that would mean is that everybody would be offended and would want you off the air.
You're completely correct. And I think it harkens back in a lot of ways to what you and I were talking about last week with the fact that, you know, the newer generations, the younger generations, don't get it.
Right.
They don't remember, so they don't have any idea. And with the way that people are now almost programmed to feel one way versus the other, and that's it. There's no gray areas. They don't understand the concept of what comedy really was about. I am sure that if you sat a whole bunch of them down and made them watch, and again, I'm not going to go off on a tangent, but made them watch the old Warner Brothers cartoons, they would be apoplectic,
right,
with the fact that, you know, everybody was fair game.
Yeah. Well, you look at what happened this week, and not to go off on yet another tangent, you look at what happened this week with the response to the Pepsi commercial, with Kendall Jenner or whoever it was coming and handing the cop a Pepsi, and it, you know, it cures whatever the crowd was protesting about, and everybody lost their minds, and oh, for Christ, who gives a shit? It's a commercial.
Oh, I know.
Man.
Exactly correct.
Yeah, but the manufactured outrage machine is just, it gets rolling and there's no stopping.
Well, you just said the key words, manufactured outrage
yep.
machines. You know, what do they call them? The social justice warriors?
Yeah, right. Oh.
I think that's a very, 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 a very apt phrase,
yep.
unfortunately. You know, it's the newer, more teeth-gnashing, tension-creating strain of what political correctness was in the 90s.
Right.
This is far worse.
Yeah. And
far worse. Because these people are calling for censorship, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't do a commercial. You can't say this. You have to come up with 50,000 different subtitles or different names because I don't want to be labeled as, you know, X, Y, or Z. Well, you know what? I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, tough shit. You know, sometimes people say things about you you're not going to like. You better learn to grow up and get over it. And keep in mind, I mean, we were talking about this is, you know, the... Not to always draw things in right and left, because it's not quite that simple. It's a little more nuanced than that. But this is the new left's version of Tipper Gore.
Yeah.
I mean, the censorship has never been too far away from what they're about. And yet they look at the right and say they're the ones responsible for censorship. And it's like, pay attention to what you're doing.
It is completely correct. You know, that, and you're absolutely 100% on the mark. When this is indeed, you know, and we're not being political here. We are looking at it from an observational point of view, and this is exactly what the new extreme left is.
Yep.
And I don't see that much of a difference between the new extreme left and the Tea Partiers of a few years ago, the extreme right. When you go to an extreme, you're only serving to eventually piss everybody off.
Right.
The louder you shout, the deafer I become.
Yeah.
And it's very simple.
Right.
And I don't have time or patience for it.
And Bill Maher has pointed this out on his show on HBO several times. It gives the people who get sick of it and run to Donald Trump fuel.
Yes.
Keep it up.
They call them when the campaign was on? The precious petals.
Yes.
And I indeed will maintain that phrase, because they're still out there and they are still pissing me and a lot of people off, and I frankly don't want to hear it.
Right.
I don't have the time, I don't have the patience, I certainly don't have the interest or wherewithal to listen to this kind of jive.
Yeah.
I don't want to know. You know, you seem to have a problem with someone everywhere and something everywhere. Well, good. Then it just says to me, don't ever come out of your house, because the whole world's going to piss you off.
Yeah, right. In my response, I mean, in my 9-to-5 or whatever it is job that I do every day as a talk show host, I love it when somebody says, you can't say that, because my response is, stop me.
Let them try.
Yeah, exactly.
Good luck, because you know what? Sooner than later, rationality, one of my favorite words,
mm-hmm.
and one of the most favorite things that I've ever been accused of being too rational. Once upon a time, rationality will always win out of this kind of irrational, self-serving, mealy-mouthed, lacking any kind of testicular fortitude. And ooh, if I sound sexist because I'm bringing up testicles, so be it. You know what? It just tells me whoever is in that kind of bag or vein is just weak and backsliding.
Yeah, right. It's like this term microaggression that has cropped up over the last couple of years. You know what? My thought on that is, if it's a microaggression, it should be that much easier for you to get over it. We've got
exactly.
A whole bunch more to cover. Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you talking it over. I want to get into some of the pop culture stuff. I know we mentioned the specter of Donald Trump a couple of minutes ago. We'll get back to that, because it actually was a pretty big week in the changing the political landscape. But there are some things going on in music that bear some looking at, because you have done it again, Rob Ross, introduced us to another band that I'm really fond of. I love the direction. I love what they're going after, I think. Tell us about Buttercup.
Interesting band, very interesting band, because they've been around for about 15 or 16 years, but they didn't start technically as a band in the traditional sense. They're more of a performance art collective out of San Antonio.
Neo Devo, yeah, right.
And you know, it's a wonderfully melodic and very, I dare say, traditionally structured rock record. You know, and emphasizing on rock when you listen to it. You know, it's not that cutesy contrived theater rock that seems to be so in vogue right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not trying to sound so tuneless that you don't want to listen to it, because that seems to be the other end of that spectrum. It's just a really good guitar-based, in-your-face powerhouse. It's a much more, I liken it in its own way to a very, very, very palatable, and I like this band a lot, but a very palatable version of Queens of the Stone Age.
Yeah.
Queens of the Stone Age might be a little too hard or a little too obtuse for people to digest, Buttercup is kind of the nicer side of that, if you will.
Yeah, and Battle of Flowers is the new album that's out from them. And it's interesting because I was listening to a couple of the studio tracks that they have linked on their webpage, which, by the way, is buttercult.com. But I was listening to a couple of the tracks on there, and a lot more of that melody comes through. You've got linked on the page, along with your review of it, a bit of live music that they did via YouTube. And what comes through in that live recording is a little more of a kind of a almost a Neil Young kind of delivery. And I love it. The thing is, they're talented at doing both. They both sound good.
Well, the thing is that they can bridge every gap. They can play the Neil Young melodic stuff, but then they can also get poppy and experimental and, dare I say, neo-psychedelic. I mean, there's one track on there called, I think it's called Vicious Rewind. The middle of the song actually goes into one of those Spirit of 67 kind of waltz time breaks / dream sequences.
It's like a vicious dream in a high school where you're trapped, and the students know how to stab you when you turn.
And it's very Syd Barrett or dare I say Bee Gees-esque, especially if you think about the Bee Gees from that first four album period. You know, it's the fact that this band, or this collective, if you will, of musicians, has the talent and ability to write songs with those kinds of structures.
Yeah.
It is not an easy thing to do by any stretch. I don't even think I've ever attempted, I should actually, to write a song that's got, you know, waltz time in it. Just to laugh.
Right, just to see what happens. And speaking of your own music, by the way, we've talked a little bit before on the radio version of this about the Co-op Communique, and there's more of this music coming out. This is something that, again, another one of the Pop Dosers, D.W. Dunphy, is responsible for sort of kicking this one in the butt and getting it going. What is the Co-op Communique?
It is a compilation of independent musicians who, thanks to the incredible, almost Herculean efforts of Mr. Dunphy, have their music exposed to a great audience, greater audience than any could conceive of on a daily basis, by him taking the time, effort, energy, love, and passion to put out this compilation of songs. And they get to have their talents and works exposed.
It's very much in the mixtape vein. It has that feel to it that DW is saying, you know what, here's a bunch of great music that you wouldn't find otherwise, and check this out. And it very much has that kind of easygoing vibe to it. But I understand that one of the guest stars that we have on Co-op Communique Volume 3, which is about to come out in the not-too-distant future, is on this show.
Oh, that asshole? Fucking guy.
What do you got for us, Rob Ross?
well, you know, immodestly speaking, it was a song John and I knocked off in the back of the van when we were on our way to Paris. Oh, sorry, never mind. Delusions of adequacy. What this is, actually, is, because Mr. Dunphy was kind enough to let me contribute the unreleased second single from the Punchline to Volume 2, which I'm very proud to this day and immensely moved by the fact that it's out there and people can hear it. Mm-hmm. But this time, I actually contributed a demo. So it is me playing all the parts. A song I wrote and recorded literally in the same day back in at the end of 1997. Mm-hmm. And it's a song I really like, actually, which is kind of hard for me to say. I don't mean that to sound obnoxious. It's just that this one's a great pop song.
Yeah.
And it's called Your Eyes. And it's very, you know, it's very catchy. It's very straightforward. It's, you know, no funny business, no bullshit about it. It's just a pop song. And hopefully people will dig the fact that it's just, one person doing all the parts because he's trying to put together a structured piece of work. It was recorded on a 4-track Tascam Porta 07 cassette deck. So, but I think I acquitted myself pretty nicely with the very economical Peter Buck guitar solo and the very Paul McCartney-esque bass line.
Good man. All right. So we'll be looking for that. And when Co-op Communique Volume 3 becomes available, where will it be available?
I would suggest going to the actual website on Bandcamp, but also check it out on Facebook, and everybody who's involved with it will all know the definitive places of where you can get this.
Excellent.
But it will be out on May 26th. We have a while to go, but it will be out.
Good. So we'll talk more
and
about
by
that.
By the way, besides myself, I just, we should mention some of the absolute talents like Lisa Michaels, Andy Klingensmith, The Ravines are on this, Lindsay Wells is on this, Gretchen's Wheel. So, again, people really need to, and Mike Indest is on this also, as he was on the last one. It's really about hearing different styles of great music by a complete host of different artists.
Excellent. So we'll be on the lookout, and when we get a little closer to the release, we'll mention it to you again, that Co-op Communique Volume 3 is on its way out. And in the meantime, we have one more piece of new music to talk about, and this one, we've been talking about Lisa Saeed. You did the interview with her, reviewed her record, and now there's a new piece of music out from her that has a charitable effort behind it all. Tell us why she re-recorded Candy Says.
One, it's because she loves anything from the Velvet Underground.
How can you not?
That's an automatic given.
Yep.
But the motivation behind this is to split whatever proceeds from the download sales would be to two Washington-based women's groups, the Washington Area Women's Foundation and Casa Ruby. So without fail, without question, without any messing about, first and foremost, it's a great rendition. Her voice is perfect for this song. She gives it a warmth and an emotion that, now I am not, you know how you said you never were really down with Rickles?
Yeah.
I've never really been down with the Velvet Underground,
okay,
truth be told. I don't, I don't not like them. I appreciate what they did, but I was never influenced by them. I never got what the big hoopla was about.
Yeah, right.
She gives the song an emotion and a warmth that Lou Reed never could.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And, she's got a delivery on the song that makes you feel it, There's an ache in this.
I want to know completely what are the souls discreetly talk
Having said that, as I said from the very beginning, the motivation is what's key. And I think it's fantastic that she is doing this in this manner and that she had a chance to do this while she's working on what will be her next album. So another serious tip of the hat and a nod of appreciation to Lisa Saeed for doing this in the way she's doing it.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. I admire it.
And I'll tell you what, her voice, we've talked about so much, and I mean, there's only so much you can say about a voice like hers that's so just clear and gorgeous, but in addition to that, on this version of Candy Says, the way that the guitars are layered right at the beginning of this song is a grabber. I mean, whoever came up with that particular arrangement on it, that's a piece of brilliance right there. So go and check it out. You can listen to the song itself on popdose.com, and there's more information about it in Rob's column about the charitable effort behind all of this. And good for Lisa Saeed again for nailing it. Just another terrific effort from her. And as we leave music, at least for just a little while, Speaking of absolutely nailing it, you and I have talked before in these kinds of almost awed tones about the work that Keith Creighton has done for Popdos. And whether it's reviewing a record or writing a column about something that happens to be going on, whether it's in his life or doing interview, whatever it is that Keith does, he has the ability to have an emotional input into what he's doing that I think is key in all great writers. You have to, especially if you're going to rip open your own life, as Keith has, you have to be able to do it fearlessly. And from Keith's writing, he's got to be one of the bravest people walking the earth. Talk about what he went over in his latest column for Popdos.
Well, let's start with the fact that what you just said may be an actual understatement.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
The word courage probably doesn't do him justice. You know, we've all got things in our lives that are good. Some of us have things going on in our lives which are not good.
Mm-hmm.
But Keith has laid himself open in a way that is, I think the only word that I would say might be appropriate here is fearless, because he has put himself right out there, not on the chopping block, but he's just opened up his entire life for everyone to see.
Yep.
And that it takes some kind of fortitude that I sure as fuck do not have. And, you know, the problems in my life are, I think, almost the ups and downs.
Right.
Let's put it that way. In my life are absolutely nothing in comparison, because I think they're all almost trite and superficial. When you read the fact that Keith is pouring his heart, his feelings, his innermost, he's letting us read his diary is what he's doing.
Yeah.
And that takes willingness to be able to do something that very few people have the capability of doing.
Yeah.
And I have to say to you, I was kind of hedging how do we approach this conversation, because we should have had it when he put up his first column, the introductory column, because it is such a personal story. It's such a very deep story, but he's putting himself out there to share it. And the reason why I wanted to talk about it is simply because some of the words that he said, well, I have not been going through the best of times in my own life, really, really hit me in a way that put tears in my eyes, let alone rattled me to my absolute foundation. And if I may, I'd like to read a little piece of what he said.
Yeah.
Now, he's talking about one of the first things, and I really hope Keith does not become angered by us talking about this or me reading it, but, you know, he went through or is going through a divorce after 8 years of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's just an ugly situation for anyone to ever endure. So, you know, the fact that he's sharing this is enough, okay? But he's talking now about the first weekend without, or in his new digs, without his wife being there. And he says, as the weekend progressed, the weight of frustration, shame, and loss hit me. My darkest thoughts started getting tactical. I plotted out the logistics of ending my life and sparing friends, family, and society from the garish sight of an ugly dude in a dress. Now, those words hit me in a way that very few people have had, because it hit home, you know?
Yeah.
When you get to that lowest ebb in your life, when things are so bleak that you actually look at the finite alternative, and then you see your way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I will forever be indebted to him for writing those words. Because, you know, when you get to that point of emotional despair, you do one of two things. You take that ugly turn, that final turn, or you find a way out of it. Now, getting away from that, and I want to thank him for saying that, because I think it helped me clear up a lot of the aggravations that have been going on in my own life. And we'll talk about that someday, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But Keith's story is actually very simple. He has announced himself as being transgender. And he has done it in a way that I think is remarkable, because he did it in a step-by-step sharing process with people. And whether it was by the people on Facebook who he's friends with, or the folks at Popdos who he's part of the family, you know, it doesn't matter. He's done it in a very matter of fact, no self-pity, no I've been tortured by this. No, he's just told the story in the steps that he can tell it.
Yeah.
And I think that is beyond admirable. And this particular column from this week's part of the story is how he felt that he had reached the bottom and then saw a video by a woman who is transgender and told her story. And then he decided that he's going to interview her and swim his way back up to the surface. And in the process, he did this fantastic interview with her. But more importantly, he's given another glimpse to everyone of how he is dealing with the realities of what he's trying to cope with on a day-to-day basis, never mind the day-to-day coping with trying to raise a child while going through a divorce and getting used to living alone again.
Yeah.
Because all of the above I am familiar with in my own way, with the exception of raising a child. But, it's that whole feeling of when you have reached an emotional bottom and there's really nowhere else to go.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, the first one made me weep, but it made me weep in a good way because I was happy for him that he was able to take the proverbial giant step and basically say, as corny as it sounds, this is who I really am.
Right, here's me.
Right, and I hope you'll accept me. And he didn't do it in a demanding way, which a lot of people will do.
Yep.
There are those that don't know how to deal with people. He obviously has a very good way with people. And so he said, I hope you'll join me on my journey. And I don't think there's anyone without a half a brain or certainly without a whole heart that wouldn't want to see how he progresses.
Right.
Because he has to know that he's loved and respected and completely championed. But for him to write the little thing about, reaching that darkest point, because it was while I was mired in my own hang-ups, that got me to snap out of it. So mm-hmm. to him, I say directly, I owe you one, brother.
There you go. And the thing is about the way that he's writing this, as you said, he's letting us read his diary as he goes through all of these things and, the changes that happen in a life. And the thing is that here he is dealing with, whatever he's dealing with inside his own body and inside his own mind, he's very matter of fact about all of that. But at the same time, he's involved in, because of external forces, one of the most contentious issues that America is facing today. You look at what's going on in North Carolina. It's clear that this is not a settled thing as far as other people's opinions go. The great thing about Keith is that, as you said, he's not forcing anybody to go along on this journey or telling them what to think about it. He's simply telling them, this is who I am and this is what I'm doing. And it is much more, I think, important to listen to Keith than it is to listen to a bunch of politicians debate shit they have absolutely no experience with. I mean, and he doesn't do it. It doesn't seem as doing this with any kind of an agenda. He's simply saying, if you want to know what it is, this is what it is.
And you know what? It goes right back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. It's not kowtowing or catering
right
to one side or the other. The warring factions, both sides of both the moral bastions of this whole thing, whether it's the right and the Christians and whoever the fuck it is who have this bizarro thing and hang up, and then the other assholes on the far left who want to talk about 50,000 ways that you can name somebody with this whole cisgender thing. And don't even get me started on that, because
yep.
We're not going to have that fucking conversation.
Right.
Both sides there are wrong. Keith is coming from look, I'm a human being.
Yep, exactly.
Dig me or don't dig me, and that's it. And be really beyond that, who gives a shit? A person has a right to do what they want to do to make themselves happy.
Exactly.
There are those who are going to go to extremes, but they're also immature fucking idiots. Keith is a very, very well-rounded, well-educated, very solid individual. You're not going to find too many others like him on any given day in any plane of life.
Right.
This is a guy who was willing to rip his life open to the core. You think he just went into this willy-nilly because it's now suddenly a trend or a fad? No.
Right.
And I really hope nobody tries to compromise him into any of that kind of shit, because I think he's too smart to get sucked into it anyway. But,
yep.
The fact is, He's written two of the most powerful pieces that Papdos has certainly ever delivered. And God bless him for it, and I hope he keeps doing it.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
People need to find, if anything, a spark of inspiration or hope, whether you're dealing with your own questions of your sexuality, dealing with a divorce, dealing with raising children, it doesn't matter. He's got something to say, and he says it eloquently and very simply that even an asshole like me, who is so far up his own ass at the time, can understand it and you know, see his way out of it.
Yeah, there you go. And again, it's up there for you on the page at popdose.com. Keith Creighton, he's a tremendous writer. He's a terrific human being. And boy, does he know his music as well. So go read what he's got on the page in all of the columns. But these latest two, as you said, just some incredibly important pieces. So do that thing. And Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you, just kind of hanging out, doing some talking about some of the things going on in the world. We also have hockey season winding down. We've got baseball season cranking up. And now that the regular season in baseball has started off, I mean, is there even anything?
It's not already is what it's doing. Okay, you know, the Mets win two games from the Braves, lose one in extra innings, showing me once again the fucking bullpen. I can see the two problem pitchers right there. I saw it the night that they lost that game, and then they lose two to the Marlins.
Yeah, right.
In a really embarrassing fashion, they get drubbed both nights. Fuck that. And then, of course, the Rangers don't even bother to show up to the net for their next-to-last game in Ottawa yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Jesus Christ. It's called maybe they'll win one game against the Canadiens in this first round of the playoffs. Maybe. But they're getting bounced. They're not making a second round. No fucking way.
Right. Well,
now I'm done.
The only good thing I can say about that is that that means that we'll probably get an old Adams division matchup in round two with Montreal taking on Boston. So it'll take me back to the days of my youth. But beyond that...
Well, I guess that I'd have to go with Boston because I hate the Canadiens.
Same here.
I absolutely do. I think the Canadiens finally surpassed my hatred of the Flyers, which once Eric Lindros came to the Rangers, I really didn't have any reason to have any beef with the Flyers anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, my beef carried on simply because I couldn't see Van Beesbrouck in a Flyer uniform. That really pissed me off
right.
for a couple of years. But, you know, I really hate the Canadiens because it always seems, especially when it comes to Hockey Night in Canada, when they actually show that on NHL channel,
mm-hmm.
they always seem to get that kind of the linesmen are always giving them the calls that they shouldn't be getting. And I don't care if it's against the Rangers, against the Make-Beliefs, against anybody else. It's just that they always seem to get that preferential treatment. Conspiracy theorists? Nah, I'm just realistic.
You got it, man. Well, it's going to be, I think, you know, you look at the Western Conference in the playoffs, and I know you're an Eastern Conference guy, but I still think there's a tremendous amount of talent in the West, and it's going to be fun to watch and see who emerges from that thing. And as long as it's not San Jose, everything will be fine. So
I was going to say, why do you have a beef with San Jose? I'd like to see them win it. I think I would like to see them win it over the Kings or over the Ducks. Who wants a team called the Ducks?
Yeah.
The fucking Mighty Ducks.
Right.
No. That's embarrassing.
True
that
enough.
They just went and shortened it back to the Anaheim Ducks. Well, that's, I guess, small compensation, but Mighty Ducks of Anaheim, they've already won a goddamn Stanley Cup, and they don't deserve any more, and I hate the fucking Kings. You know?
Well, you know,
being
in St. Louis, though, and as a Blues fan, I would see the Blues were, even when I was a kid, they were my my Western Conference team, and... Yeah, I don't know why. I just always had an affinity for them, and so now that I live here, even more so. And San Jose has knocked St. Louis out of the playoffs so many times, so
I
just can't handle them. But either way, I mean, like I said, it's going to be fun to watch, and you know, who knows? Baseball's a long year, so we'll see what happens and whether the Mets can put it back together.
Since the Rangers are going to lose anyway, let the Atlanta Flames win one, huh?
There you
go. Am I right?
Yeah. And then we can bring back, the Hartford Whalers and Lusapeg.
Kansas City Scouts.
Yeah, the Lusapeg Jets are already back, so.
Yeah, but that was them stealing a team from Atlanta.
Right.
Atlanta plants the teams, lets them grow, and then Canada steals them. The kind of chicanery that goes on with that NHL.
That's it.
Know? And of course, who else? The Quebec Nordiques.
The Nordiques, that's right, yeah. Where's now I can't even remember his name. Oh, who was the blonde-haired kid who played for Quebec early on? Oh,
Peter
man.
Forsberg.
Huh?
You're not thinking of Peter Forsberg, are you?
No. Nah, it's gone. Either way. It would just be nice to see that weird N with a hockey stick attached to it again. And
it took me years to figure out who the hell that team was, just like it took me years to figure out who the Vancouver Canucks were, because all it was just this stick.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't say anything that says Vancouver.
And then it was that hideous flaming skate that just...
That obnoxious, the shit-colored uniform?
Yes,
oh, yeah.
Exactly.
That's the 1994 Rangers win the Stanley Cup uniform. That's all
right.
I need to know.
Good,
you know?
Man. So that's all happening, and of course we'll keep an ear close to it. You'll get the NFL draft coming up sometime shortly as well, so there's at least some kind of reason in the midst of all of these doldrums to be happy about what's going on in football. But then we turn our attention to the rest of the newspaper, and it just gets ugly again. So where to even start? Well, there is one good thing that happened. Steve Bannon is off the National Security Council, so fuck him.
Yes, thankfully for Jared Kushner, being his bone of contention. Gee, I wonder why.
Right, yeah.
Jared's a J-E-W.
Yeah, you don't think that's got anything to do with it, do you?
Bannon doesn't like J-E-W-S.
That's what I hear. So, yeah, and now, I mean, the rumor is that he and Ryan Priebus are both looking at being shown the door. But, you know, as soon as they come out with the vote of confidence, that's when we'll know it's over. As soon as they say, well, the president gave Steve Bannon a vote of confidence, that's when you know he's about 15 minutes away from getting shit canned.
Come to think of it, where's Skeletor? Nobody's seen her lately.
Yeah, that's true.
She's, you know, in absentia, isn't she?
Huh. Yeah, interesting that.
I'm just saying.
Okay.
You know?
So we'll keep an ear on that one as well. And in the midst of all of this, of course, when they're really starting to get somewhere with a Russia investigation, what do? Bomb something.
Right. And now, because, you know, everybody's figured that one out, now you send ships into the Korean Peninsula.
Right.
Because you really want to wave a red flag at the little bull from North Korea, don't you?
Yeah. When was the last time he actually did anything dangerous? So, yeah, it's just stupid.
He got his hair cut. That was a dangerous thing.
Yeah, right. And he looks like Gumbo from the old Gumby adventures. He looks like Gumby's dad, Gumbo. They got the same haircut. But yeah, I mean, the thing with Syria, I mean, how can, even in a head that's that muddled and that addled, how can it not sink through that you go, oh, I saw those babies and it made me so sad that I had to go and bomb them. And you think, okay, but you won't let those babies into the country because you think they might be terrorists?
Right. I mean, it's always the double-edged sword of hypocrisy, especially when it comes to Trump, you know, and I got to tell you, whenever I watch him speak, I have to admit, I cringe.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen bad public speakers before. I mean, genuinely bad public speakers. You know, when we're students and they make us get in front of the classroom, we're nervous or what have you, but you learn after a while, especially when you're in college. I think one of the requirements is actual, like, a speech class, public speaking, because you have to learn how to present. And we've had presidents who could, you know, barely find their asses if you gave them a map and a flashlight.
Right. But boy, could they talk.
But this guy, when he opens his mouth to speak, I genuinely cringe, physically cringe, because he's a moron.
Right. Yeah.
You know, his whole pattern just doesn't work. First of all, staring the way he does at the teleprompter makes him look like a bigger moron, because it says you can't do this thoughtfully,
right,
naturally, humanely, or humanly for that matter.
Yeah, well, it's because he has a tremendous problem being able to read, and that's why. I mean, that's why you get that blank death stare at the teleprompter. He's trying to sound the words out in his head.
And I'm telling you something, it really makes things brutally uncomfortable. Because, you know, obviously, because he's a politician, just by that alone, you know, the quote default factor,
mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to think right away, well, he's insincere as fuck. But I mean, he makes it even worse because he's such a lousy reader.
Yep.
So now it sounds like, you know, somebody's just force feeding you the lines and you don't really give a shit and you don't believe it. You know, part of the job of president is being convincing.
Yeah.
Even if you're wrong,
right,
through and through. You say what you will about, you know, George W. Bush.
He believed
it. He was wrong, but he believed it, and he, you know, he tried to be sincere.
Yep.
You know? Bill Clinton could not have been more full of shit than anybody. But he was the master
at making
of
you think
sincerity and make it.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you one thing, people.
Yeah.
First and foremost, I did not have sex with that woman. Now, by what you mean by sex, I mean I don't consider a Hummer in the Oval Office, you know, having sex. I mean, sex is when you're on full-on en flagrante, you know what I mean? Go, baby. I'm telling you, I did not have sex with her, and you're going to believe me because I'm Slick Willie.
Yeah.
You know, he had the way. Yeah, even fucking Nixon.
Right.
Nixon, you knew he was full of shit, and you knew he was stealing the silverware. But for fuck's sake, at least he knew how to talk to a goddamn camera.
Yeah, exactly. Or to just talk to another human being, which is where it's starting to get really hairy now when he's talking with, you know, with the premiers of other countries like China. And you think, oh, what is he saying? What kind of dumb shit is he saying when the cameras aren't on? And that's why I think is the real worry right now, is that there's going to come a time when he's going to be called upon to actually do part of the job. And I just have no faith that he's going to be able to pull it off.
I have no faith. I have zero, you know. Zero confidence in him. And at the same time, I know this is, you know, comparing apples to bananas, but, you know, I've got zero faith in Mike Pence because he's just he's the opposite end of the evil spectrum, because he really is one of those fucking weirdo Christian zealots who seems to have that men's room stance for the airport. I don't know why. It's just something doesn't sit right with me about him. And that's a kind of off-color comment. I mean, I'm not the only one out there who thinks this guy's a little too gung-ho on the concept of, you know, conversion therapy.
Yeah, that any time that starts to come up, you start to get a little bit worried. So, yeah, it's the next 4 years. I mean, we keep counting down the days, and they keep not moving fast enough. So we'll see what happens, but it's never boring. You got to give it that. And there's
you've got eeny, meeny, miny, you know. I mean, you've got fucking Trump, Pence, and that other fucking knob shiner, Paul Ryan, who I really hate. You know, I genuinely hate Paul Ryan more than the other two assholes.
Yeah.
Oh, and that other prick, Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
Can I say that? Sure I can. Why? Because I'm an American, and it's my constitutional right. Those two motherfuckers are the bane of this country.
Well, yeah. And with Paul
Trump
Ryan,
and Pence, that small beer in comparison with those two dicks
right.
still being in control of the whole shit show.
And yeah, I mean, when it comes to Paul Ryan specifically, his biggest tell, and I mean, the one thing that I think if people would just take the time, the 5 seconds that it takes to analyze what he did, and you think to yourself, how easy was it? And how quickly did the shift come when it came time for Paul Ryan to sell out his integrity? And it happened in nothing flat, and the stakes weren't even that high. And he still did it. So what's going to happen when something really important comes along? He's going to fold like a cheap suit.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Yeah, it's just it's terrible.
it's terrible, as it's embarrassing, and it's aggravating because it just leads to more of the same shit not getting done.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. Exactly.
I mean. Well, you know what? Let's go back to a lighter theme, because you know what? Politics does make me angry.
Fair enough. All right. Well,
you wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because I spent a little time this weekend at a comics convention. So there was plenty of Hulk around, and there was plenty of everything around. And you know what's funny? We talked about this a little bit before the show, that comic book conventions aren't just that anymore. And I'd never been to one of these things, so I didn't know what to expect other than a lot of people in costume, and there were. But there were Gene Simmons was there. And he's a cartoon character, I guess, so it makes some kind of sense. But Peter Tork and Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees were both there. There were a bunch of actors. There were a bunch of voice actors. And so it was more than just what you would expect from the typical comic book type crowd. And, you know, it was fun. It was one of those things. They're so easy to target and deride and talk about what a bunch of geeks they are. But you know what? They found their thing, and they love their thing. So, yeah, if you let yourself go and just have fun while you're there, there's a lot of fun to be had in places like that.
Absolutely. Look, you know, I think you and I talked about it when I went to the B Beatlefest on the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' arrival in America. And I said I'd had my apprehensions and had never been willing to go previously simply because I always likened a Beatlefest to a comic book convention or a sci-fi or Star Trek or whatever. And I had that kind of snobbery about it.
Mm-hmm.
But having experienced the negative side of something like the Beatles convention, the Beatlefest, if you can go and enjoy it, then God bless.
Right.
Because that's what it's about, just going and enjoying, If you're really into comic books, which I have never been in my entire life, great. Listen, if there was a big star convention, my ass is going to be there.
Right, right. And
so, who's to say anything about anyone going and enjoying? Now, the interesting thing that Chaim Witz was there, of course why he's going to be at a comic book convention, because when he was a teenager, that was his bag. That was his thing in trade,
Right.
He would get old comic books and sell them, because what's Simmons all about? Money.
Making money.
So, there's big money to be made, and I'm sure he was trying to make a deal somewhere along the lines. Plus, we all had the Kiss comic book with their blood, in it.
Right.
I mean, come on.
$120 an autograph each. Yeah, he was making some cash. And I'm glad you mentioned the Star Trek thing as well, because I almost forgot that also in the celebrity little table area that they had set up, Nichelle Nichols was there. Lieutenant Uhura was sitting just a couple of feet away from me. And I want to tell you something. She's 84 years old. And in a room full of 84-year-olds, you would walk through and go, man, she was sexy. It's like she still has it, because you can see that she still has it.
You know who else still has it at 83?
Who?
Julie Newmar.
Oh, yeah.
Batwoman.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's an air, there's a way of carrying themselves that, you can tell. You just look at her and you go, yeah, you're 84 years old, but I bet, when you were 40, when you were 30, when you were 20, you were just stunning and you know it. It's like you still get it.
Yep.
It's funny.
Absolutely agreed.
So good for her. Yeah. And like I said, for everybody, they were just having a good time and they were in their element. So it was kind of nice to see. But boy, those things are just money generators like nobody else's business.
Try coming to a Comic-Con in New York.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Either go broke or you at least have to come with a bag of cash at the ready.
Indeed. You're listening to Radio City, John Grace and Rob Ross. And it's time to go in our heads, because, this has grown into, I think, our favorite thing, the thing we look forward to the most every week, because we just get to talk about exactly that, whatever it is, musically or otherwise, that has been in our heads this week. And for me, it's songs that are very, very wordy. And it's because I went back and listened to the Bruce Springsteen version of Blinded by the Light. Of course, the original version. He did, after all, write the song. And it struck me, after listening to it four or five times through, that there are three or four verses, I think, in that song that they cut out in the Manfred Mann version. Even though they sing a lot of words in that song, they cut out a bunch of it. And, you think about what was going through Bruce's head as he got to, the fourth notebook page and was still writing,
But don't do it here. Well, I jumped up, turned around, spit in the air, fell on the ground, asked him which was the way back home. He said, take a right at the light, keep going straight until night, and then, boys, you're on your own. And now M's lands a bar, shooting star, riding in a sidecar, humming a lunar tune. Yes, I'm the avatar, step below the bar, first you move the cookie jar with one tea. Those boys are left too soon. And some's getting that handicap, was complaining that it caught the clap from some mousetrap he bought last night. Well, I unsnapped the skull cap between his ears, I saw a gap and figured he'd be alright. He walked up blinded by the light.
And there's a certain coolness to songs like that. There's like Blinded by the Light. There's The End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine by R.E.M. There's We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel. There are those songs that, even though they're still kind of the same length as your average song, they're just words from beginning to end. And I think they're fun. I think most of, even the ones you don't really love all that well, they're still fun to listen to.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's the End of the World as We Know It is actually the bastardization or a rewrite of a song that was originally written and done around the time of Life's Rich Pageant, because End of the World came on Document, the next album.
Yeah.
A song called Bad Day. Bad Day actually did make an appearance around 2003, I think, as one of the, quote, new songs for the Best Of compilation that had come out at the time. But it is just as wordy, if not clumsier, verbally, when you try and, you know, read off the words the way that the flow of It's the End of the World as We Know It goes.
Right.
But there you go. There is a sister piece, a companion piece right there, you know? Now, frankly speaking, you know, I can't stand either song. You know, that's, of course, you know, I think it's pretty well known to all and sundry that Document was where the switch went off for me with REM.
Right.
You know, but c'est la vie. Yeah, I still had some things that I liked by them intermittently, but that was the end of the whole, you know, I want to be Michael Stipe kind of thing. You know, that was, you know,
right,
over and done with, because that's when I cut my hair, too. interestingly enough, you bring up Springsteen and the verses that are cut out. Here's one for you that I'm sure you must have thought of, but Mr. Tambourine Man.
Yeah.
Is a long-ass fucking song.
Yep, and Dylan had a few of them, sure.
Yeah, Dylan's verses, how many goddamn verses are in there? Five, I think?
Yeah.
The Birds only do the chorus and half of one.
Right, yeah, like a half a verse. Yeah, exactly. And it's still, you know, their version, whenever the Birds tackled Dylan, I think they did it really well. And there's a lot of those songs that I like when, you know, what they did with them better than I like what Dylan did with them.
Yeah, well, that's not hard, frankly. And I'm saying that in all honesty, because as great of a writer he is, his voice just, it's hard to really love it. It works great on some songs. When he started to actually rock, like around the time of Maggie's Farm,
yep,
and Subterranean Homesick Blues, or
there's, you know, another one of those songs,
right? Or Most Likely You'll Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine. You know, that's where you can really dig Dylan's voice, because it fits the song like a Rolling Stone, six minutes and change.
Yep,
I mean, that broke a time barrier to begin with. But I mean, talk about being a wordy motherfucker, you know, that time.
Princess on a steeple and all the pretty people they all drinking, thinking that they got it made. Exchanging all precious gifts, but you better take your diamond ring, you better pawn it, babe.
Was a master of wordiness.
Right. And well, that one, Subterranean Homesick Blues, that's in that same kind of staccato kind of, you know, rat-tat-tat delivery that End of the World as We Know It and to some degree Blinded by the Light, they're that same sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, even his version of that, you're right, it's one that I really enjoy.
Or Lennon, for that matter, Give Me Some Truth.
Yep.
Well,
right.
A lot of words in that,
right.
You know. But the problem with that song is it's that all that, you know, right on wanky, I'm hip and I'm with it, you know, power to the people, politicking bullshit.
Yeah.
That he actually pulled the same crap on with the song New York City, you know, just wordy nothingness.
Right.
But there's another thing. You have poetry, you have a story, if you will, in the words of the song,
mm-hmm.
where you just got, you know, word salad.
Right. And wasn't there, you know, it seems to me that there was one that was a Simon and Garfunkel song that was almost a riff on those kinds of songs. In fact, I think yes. It was a Dylan riff. So,
it's a simple desultory philippic, or How I Got Robert McNamara into Submission.
Yes.
And it's delivered in a Dylan-esque voice.
Right. Now, the boy ain't got no culture.
I have got to tell you, that was where I wanted to slap Paul Simon for being pretentious until I realized that that was a pock shot at the preciousness of Dylan and the whole, you know, Eve of Destruction kind of ilk.
Yes.
When you start writing those kinds of songs, you're going into some very murky waters.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Of course, 1965 was the year of protest music, man. But, you know, the whole thing is Simon actually was brilliant in his indictment and his attack. Although there's a guy who writes words that go on for fuck's sake. Scarborough Fair Canticle.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ. Bring me in Scarlet Battalions. Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that makes my teeth hurt, you know? Or, you know, the Boxer is a musical masterpiece, but Jesus Christ, there's a lot of words to that.
Yep. Yeah, I'm with you. And there are guys who are much, you know, it's kind of like the Oscar Wilde versus Ernest Hemingway thing. You know, where you've got guys like Eric Burdon, who wrote the same kinds of songs, but did it with half as many words, and you didn't have to look any of them up.
Keeping it simple and keeping it clear is what I think connects better with people in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Look, Ray Davies is the perfect embodiment of how you write a song, lyrically.
Right, right.
He tells stories, and they're usually under about 3 to 4 minutes. Look at Waterloo Sunset.
Yeah.
You have a complete story in there from start to finish.
Right.
I know I riff on this album a lot, but Something Else by the Kinks, I still think, is his greatest achievement.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, Two Sisters tells a complete story of two different people in one sitting and in less than 4 minutes.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. So,
I mean, my God.
Maybe that should be the next step in this conversation is that since we talked about the wordy songs, maybe the economy of words is what we can hit next time around.
Oh, I can think of two shining examples of how you become economical very quickly.
Tell me.
But then we'd be going into a different genre of music completely.
Yeah.
Because we kind of stay away from my youthful wheelhouse of punk rock.
Right.
And I'm not talking about, you know, the stupidity or the uneducatedness of the Sex Pistols or the Clash using last week's headlines as this week's new single.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm talking about writing really short, sharp, artistic jags like Wire and the Minutemen were able to achieve.
Yeah.
Both sides of the Atlantic, and also doing it in a very economic, musical time frame.
Excellent. Well, like I said, we can always go off on that at a future date. And in the meantime, anything we should be watching for in terms of your writing on Pop Dose this week? What do you got coming up?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of things coming out. I'll just let y'all go to the page, read my stuff, check out the music, read everybody else's columns, because really, you have to.
Yeah.
This isn't about me. This is about Pop Dose, and this is why we do it, because Pop Dose is, bar none, the only place where you're going to get a full span and view of the pop culture world, because everything is tied in with the real world. You
right.
know, we take so many cues of how we dress and how we speak and what we listen to, and God help us, some of the politics that people tend to ape. And it's all from pop culture, because 90% of the people I know are still what I used to always refer to as, you know, record sleeve socialists or, you know, rock and roll warriors or whatever. It's all bullshit, and you take it from your, you know, rock musician heroes. Go to Pop Dose. Have yourself some fun. Read the more hard-hitting articles like Keith's. Get an education from Ken Shane. Listen to Dave's podcast besides listening to ours. You know, Mr. Dunphy's articles. Will Harris is back. You know, just go to Pop Dose and read it and have some fun.
There you go. And click those links on the page, because there's always something there. A little extra for you, some music that you can listen to while you're reading the words on the page about it, some video. It's there for you. It's here for you. So just go enjoy. And Rob Ross, couldn't have put it better myself, man. Thank you so much. And we'll do some more Radio City next week.
As always, God willing, you better believe it.
You got it, man. Take care. And go kick around. Have some fun. We'll talk to you then.